Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this evening's event. I'm Michael Fullilove, the Executive Director of the Lowy Institute. I acknowledge that we're gathered on the land of the Gadigal people, and I pay my respects to their elders past and present. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a very distinguished room this evening. I won't mention all the VIPs because there are too many to mention, but I will call attention to two very special guests, and that is, I believe that we have two of John Curtin's great-grandchildren, Toby and Michael Davidson, in the room. Are they here? Thank you very much. Welcome. That's a very special human connection. A couple of years ago, I wrote a book about Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Hopkins, who was one of his great envoys, and I gave a speech at Glee Books. And at the end of it, various people asked me to sign the book, and one lady came up and said, "Thank you for writing this. Harry Hopkins was my grandfather." So it is a very special moment, I know, for an author when you can have the blood relatives of your subject with you for the launch of your book. It's wonderful to see a full house here this evening. Who knew, John, that there was such enormous public interest in you and me? Of course, John and I know that's not quite true. We're honoured to have with us tonight the 24th Prime Minister of Australia, Paul Keating. In 1969, Paul was elected to the House of Representatives, of course, as the member for Blaxland. He served as Treasurer and, of course, leader of the Labor Party and Prime Minister. And Paul Keating was a reforming Treasurer and Prime Minister whose brushwork on the big picture of liberal economic policy, engagement with Asia, native title and the Republic was always applied with imagination and courage. When I was a young man, I worked for Mr. Keating, and he said to me at the time, I'll never forget it, he said, "You don't make great financial income working on public issues, Michael, but you make great psychic income." And I have certainly always felt that I personally get to run a surplus on the psychic side of the balance sheet. Paul has always been seized of the great issues of the day. He's a knowledgeable student of history, including the history of the Second World War and Australia. And he has a masterful ability to connect the themes of history with the challenges of the present and the demands of the future. Let me say, ladies and gentlemen, it's a double delight to host the launch of this important new book. I might just wait. It's a double delight to host the launch of this important new book, John Curtin's War by John Edwards. First, because we like to support our friends and colleagues when they publish books. And John Edwards has had a long association with the Institute, having served as a non-resident fellow for many years. And it's all the better, of course, that he's publishing it with Ben Ball and Penguin Random House, the Lowy Institute's publisher. But secondly, it's a delight because here at the Institute, we think that history matters. We believe in remembering significant individuals and moments in Australian history. And of course, we also enjoy hosting Australians who have made a large contribution to our country. And we're doing both of these things tonight. We're delighted that Paul Keating, one of Australia's most consequential prime ministers, is here to talk about another of Australia's most consequential prime ministers, John Curtin. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Paul Keating to launch John Curtin's War. Mr. Keating. Welcome.
Well, thanks, Michael, Bob, colleagues, John, Deborah, ladies and gentlemen. Well, it's great to be back at the Lowy Institute, kind of colonised at having you in charge, Michael. I like to think so. A little bit of straying here and there, but that's okay. We understand. It's an even more pleasant occasion to be here on the occasion of launching John Edwards' book, John Curtin's War. John has had an interest in Curtin for a very long time. He wrote a very important speech about Curtin, I don't know when, but about 2000 or thereabouts, but a long time ago. So he'd had this interest in him, but I hadn't known for a long time that John was actually about to undertake so serious a work as this biography, history of John Curtin and John Curtin at War. And he is without a doubt, it's a beautifully written volume, and I assume volume two is the same. And that, by that I mean researched beautifully with a narrative and a storyline that threads its way ribbon-like through the book. John goes to a great effort to paint a picture of Curtin, the individual, and to, you know, with all the due regard that Curtin is due, and to give us the colour of his life and what sort of person he was, and to remind us how Australia was in those days. You know, how simple the country was, how relatively poor it was, how these people who came along rather determinedly, as Curtin did, represented over time so much. He has these very nice things to say about him. He says it was his intelligence, his earnestness, his knowledge of his weaknesses, his silences, his distance. He had some kind of moral authority, you know, difficult to find, but undeniably there, which I think for those of us who have been interested in Curtin, interested enough to read about him, could identify that. And he says, you know, in the official picture, of course, after he's sworn in, he says, in his expression, there's no grandeur, no easy command, no triumph. He looks ill at ease, but he has sincerity, intelligence and reserve, a very nice and normal human being. He is an adroit and accomplished politician, unusually free of vanity or illusion. And as we know, he became Prime Minister on the votes of two independents in the House of Representatives on the fall of Menzies, on the fall of Lyons, then Menzies, then, of course, Fadden short-term government. And he's there to command the war effort on the votes of two independents in the House of Representatives without a general election. And he takes the task on. You tend to kind of... I arrived in the House of Representatives in 1969, and sort of, you can say, 20 years later or 25 years later. The place was still pretty much, Canberra was still pretty much like it was probably in most of those years. And of course, I stayed, as John Curtin stayed, in the Currajong Hotel myself. And the woman who ran the place, she ran it like Stalag 17 at the time. as John said, everyone was allocated their place in the dining room. You couldn't swap places. You get spoken to. I mean, this is true in my day too. My place was allocated with Arthur Call. I got Arthur as a breakfast companion, a dinner companion. I remember the place really well. And the lady whose name escapes me now, but who took over from Miss Southwell, who ran the place in Curtin time, said that she gave me Curtin's room. So I had what she said was Curtin's room for a number of years. Of course, all the rooms were the same, pretty well. And as John said, you had to go outside and down the alley, down the corridor to go to the toilet. That was still the case when I arrived, and then there was a big revolution. They knocked one room out every two, and they put in a suite, that is, a toilet suite, connected to some room. So we crawled into the sort of 20th century at that time. But nevertheless, you are there, and of course everyone knew the room that Chifley died in, the place had a sort of drumbeat to it, and the proximity, 10 minutes proximity to Parliament House. And of course, you know, you lived in Parliament House, the furnishings were all the same furnishings that they lived in, you know, the caucus room was the same, the lounges were the green leather, it was government deco, chairs, furniture, etc. So you sort of felt you knew these things. Of course, as Prime Minister, I sort of slept in the room that Curtin died in. And so, you know, these fellows kind of follow you around, or you follow them around, as the case may be. So, but you have a feeling for their lives. The great thing about Curtin was that despite expectations, he thrived in the job. He was given the job in difficult circumstances. Menzies had collapsed. He thrived in the job. He took the right decisions, and he took them decisively, quickly. And that may be easy to say, but it requires judgment, and it requires courage to take decisions like this and to take them quickly. He turned his back on the defeatism of the Conservatives and the fact that they were so allied to the Empire and the British effort. Particularly, of course, it completely consumed them, and the belief in the British Admiralty and the strategic guarantor which Britain was, out of the sort of supposedly the Fortress Singapore and their command of the Indian Oceans and the Straits of Malacca and the rest. The same sort of faith, of course, conservative people these days put exclusively in the United States. It's a sort of it's a carbon copy of things in those days. But he became Labor leader in 1935. He pulled the Labor Party together. And then importantly, in 1936, he repaired the big schism with Lang and Lang Labor in New South Wales. John records, in March 1936, Curtin offered sincere and cordial welcome to the nine members of the Lang faction, then sitting in the caucus room after a five-year absence. And of course, at the same conference in 1936, as John records, the party sought adequate home defence against possible aggression. I mean, the Labor Party realised that Australia wasn't adequately defended, that the whole defence, in structure of defence, depended on so-called imperial defence, and that Australia had in itself no adequate policy. As John again writes, responding to the Lyons government's argument that Australia must support the Empire, which would in turn support Australia, Curtin argued for more independent defence policy. He wanted more weapons made in Australia and a bigger air force. And he goes on to say we should have a more independent foreign policy. But of course, a number of us are saying that today. Some things don't change. The thing was that the thing about Curtin was he knew that he had said that the bet to we'd put all the chips on black, and black was the British Admiralty and the ability to defend Singapore and to protect the sea lanes around Australia, and he could see that no commitment from the British Admiralty or the British Cabinet was sufficient for Australia's defence, and therefore always doubted the fact that in any stress, under stress, it would come good. And so he was very defiant in making his position clear, particularly when it became clear that particularly as the war began in Europe, and he was opposed to the AIF divisions going to the Middle East. He could see the drain on Australia and that already, He could see the vulnerabilities that Australia had, but of course he living in his day, as people were, they were more British than the British, many people, and that therefore he had to fashion a policy in response to this. Of course, the Lyons government was supporting the policy of appeasement of Germany, with, as John writes, completely without any awareness, really, of the portents in the Pacific or the dangers to Australia. Curtin predicted in a speech in 1936 that Britain couldn't be relied upon to provide a fleet at Singapore superior to any fleet Japan could put together. Lyons died on Friday, the 7th of April, 1939, at the age of of 59, and he declined to pass the leadership to Menzies, begging Bruce to accept it. Of course, you know, John will tell you anyway, Page loathed Menzies and let it be known the Country Party would never join a coalition with the UAP if Menzies led it. And Menzies was installed as leader against Casey, and the same day the Country Party exercised a veto over Menzies. That meant that if the Labor Party and the Country Party came together, they had a majority in the House of Representatives. Menzies' party did not have majority if the other curtain came together. So, of course, then the game got nasty in Europe, every instinct in Menzies' being was about Britain, imperial policy, and future. And of course, the turning point moment was Hitler's demands about the Danzig corridor, where the place which had a very large population of German-speaking people. And John records him saying, Menzies said he regarded the merits of Danzig and the corridor as quite open to argument, and suggesting Chamberlain invites Hitler to London. You can imagine the put on Menzies would have done in saying all this. Of course, Bruce, that dreadful fop Bruce, was in London urging Britain to induce the Poles to make reasonable concessions to Hitler. And then on the 1st of September 1939, Menzies said that the German proposals are surprisingly reasonable. Surprisingly reasonable. And of course, he then went on to say, I feel quite confident that Hitler had no desire for a first-class war. You could hear him saying it. And that when Hitler occupied Poland, he would offer to guarantee the integrity of Poland and only carve off Danzig and the corridor. As the font of understanding, he became, for the Nazis, he said, Germany has always seemed to me to have an almost unanswerable case in relation to the corridor. This is saying all this as Prime Minister, you know. And then he said, history will label Hitler as one of the really great men of the century. I think he has too much intelligence to cast them back into another war. You know, now this was the climate that Curtin operated in as opposition leader, as these things went on. And so you could see very quickly pick up the drumbeat there. He rejected the offer of forming a national government with Menzies, preferring to, as John records, maintain the Labour Party as a separate entity. Then watched Menzies, in a sense, decline in the period. Interestingly, John turns up a number of very important documents in the book, and this, I think, speaks of his research and the power of the narrative, where he records the defeatism of the Conservatives in Australia. And he has a note in the book which is an interesting, a very powerful note, an exchange between a recorded exchange between Australia's then Chief of the Defence Force, Sir Brudenell White, General Sir Brudenell White, and Sir Keith Murdoch, who had been appointed by Menzies Director General of Information. So Murdoch turns up to Brudenell White for, if you like, a talk about the realities of war planning, where White tells Murdoch that Australia's resistance to the Japanese would be futile because, he says, Japan within 6 months could probably subdue us by action at sea, and that we could not equip more than 130,000 fighting men anyway, and in the event we did, we can only equip them with guns and ammunition for about a month's fighting. Now, this is in June 40, just after Dunkirk, and a week before the fall of France. And I might read you some of the extract, because I think it's really very telling about the Conservatives. This is a verbatim report someone wrote this down. So Murdoch says, he's saying to Bruton and White, what would you do with your 130,000 men? How would you face the enemy on a large scale? And White says, well, 130,000 does not envisage invasion. In other words, we're not pretending that 130,000 could resist an invasion. Murdoch says, no, that would be out of the picture, not large enough. Nor can we contemplate it in our present circumstances. But would you fight an invasion? That's one of the things in the public mind. He's asking, would you fight an invasion? White says, really looking at in hard fact, there are two things that stand against you as a brick wall. The lack of ammunition and guns. If the enemy landed, they would not last over a month's fighting. Murdoch says, well, that's not something we can really tell the public. And White says, the second is that, in my view, it would be allowing for the British Navy to be wiped off. In other words, we'd assume that the British Navy had been defeated and Japan had complete control, that means control of the seas. Even if we were able to defend ourselves against invasion, Japan within 6 months could probably subdue us by action at sea. And Murdoch says, then you reach that stage, there's no possible need. Murdoch says, then you reach this stage, there's no possible need in this country for more than 130,000 trained men. In other words, if we're going to basically turn it in, if the Japanese circumvent, what's the expression, give a sea denial, then if we don't have enough equipment or ammunition for a month's thing, then why do we need an army of more than 130,000 men? Murdoch said, well, make it 150 or 200,000. In other words, there would be no need to train for local defence more than 130,000 men. They would be all you could equip and would be an adequate number for raids which are reasonably contemplated. In other words, assuming the Japanese may land in raids, 130,000 could do that. White says, this is so. So Murdoch says, yes, I suggest this is a fundamentally important fact. Well, so as John writes, he says, to Murdoch's question whether Bruton or White planned to fight an invasion, White's roundabout answer was no. It was a logical conclusion of imperial defence. Australian planning against the Japanese landing was instead based on two alternatives, defeating a small Japanese force, raids, or surrendering to a larger one. There's nothing to say about, on the contrary, Sir Keith, who later claimed credit for exposing the military disaster of the Dardanelles in the Great War, had nothing to say about this disclosure. On the contrary, he would later attack Curtin for putting the defence of Australia before the defence of Burma. But this is the punchline. That military assessment was confirmed 6 months later and given 6 days later, I'm sorry, by General Sir Bruton or White to Menzies and his ministers, and they accepted the analysis without remonstration. In other words, the chief soldier visits the cabinet and tells Menzies that absent the Imperial Navy, we could resist skirmishes, but we wouldn't be able to resist. We would have to surrender in the event the Japanese had sea denial. And then the chief of the Navy, Sir Ragnar Colvin, said that there'd be no point in holding Darwin. The whole position in regard to the defence of the northern part of Australia hinges on the battle fleet base of Singapore. If such was not changed, the situation became radically changed. The chief of the staff, White, repeated the view he'd offered to Murdoch and Menzies that Japan's attack would be against British naval forces and bases, and with their defeat and capture, Japan would bring the Commonwealth to terms by the exercise of sea power alone without the need for invasion. The army could resist only on a minor scale of attack. The two most important armed forces chiefs in Australia were completely clear-eyed, hard-headed, unabashed defeatists. There was no British battle fleet at Singapore if the United States did not come into war. Australia would have come to terms with Japan. Against this assessment, the Menzies cabinet John says, made no remonstrance. In other words, you know, how scandalous, really, how scandalous. And this is the point about Menzies, you know, that you know, vacuous dandy, who occupied the job, accepts the advice of a soldier to not resist an invasion, and then he then says, John records him saying, of the cabinet of Curtin, that they were scum. This is the scum who decided to resist the invasion of Australia by a Prime Minister, Curtin, who within days is taking the completely right decisions to recognise the impotence of the British Navy at sea in the Pacific, and to fight for what he called the battle for Australia. And so, you know, you can see there's some important things here to say about, of course, you know, he says, I'll find the note here somewhere, you know, Menzies completely hated Churchill. John records him writing to Bruce in January 40 saying, I cannot tell you adequately how much I'm convinced that Winston is a menace. You know, Winston is proselytising through the 30s that Hitler was a psychotic criminal who couldn't be dealt with, and that Britain had to arm itself against him. And of course, he's got Stanley Bruce and Page running around with Chamberlain, Lord Halifax, the Foreign Secretary, all of whom hated Churchill. I mean, they hated giving Churchill the job as Prime Minister. They hated Liberals more than they hated people in the Labor Party. They had to make him Minister for the Admiralty, First Sea Lord, when the war started. And, of course, because Halifax collapsed politically and was a member of the House of Lords, in the end, of course, they gave Churchill the job. But Churchill's job from the Conservatives in Britain was to do a trade with Hitler, you know, and that great book written by John Lukács, 5 Days in London, May 1940, records the 5 days that the reactionaries within the British Conservative cabinet try and overturn Churchill or get Churchill to understand he got the job to do a trade with Hitler, and that Mussolini would basically be called upon to officiate in the trade, to which, of course, Churchill says no. And upon that no went the whole of Western civilization. That's why I often said to people, I was in public life because of one person, Churchill, and because of the moral clarity he had, and the other one being, of course, Roosevelt, but we'll come to him later. But the point is, you see, you've got both Curtin and Churchill warning in 1936, both in the same year, about the risk to their respective countries, Britain in Europe from Germany, and Australia at risk from Japan. And, of course, the Japanese wanted to continue to subdue China, and in the end were seeking resources, rubber, oil, all the materials that they needed, and people understood that if Japan remained determined to subdue or colonise China, then in the end it would run to a Pacific war in general, which John records. You know, there is... Curtin then, of course, you know, makes the right decisions. He reverses the policy completely. He broadcasts to the nation, the government is fully prepared to hold this country, he says. Fully prepared to hold this country. And then, of course, made a number of speeches, important ones. He said he told the public in a national broadcast that they'll hold the country and keep it a citadel for the British-speaking race and as a place where civilization will persist. He told Australians the government was fully prepared. It was, in his own less flamboyant way, a message similar to that of Churchill's defiant speech 18 months earlier, where Churchill told Britons that we will fight them on the beaches and we'll fight them in the fields, we will never surrender. Could you imagine Menzies ever saying such a thing? You know, could you imagine that? And, of course, the vagabond comes back in 1949 and inherits everything from the Labor Party, you know. I mean, collapses in the face of both Nazism and militarism in Japan, collapses, his government collapses. He attacks the people who are prepared to run the fight, Churchill in Britain and Curtin in Australia, and then, of course, picks up all of the war victories and the reconstruction of Australia by the Labor Party in the 1940s and becomes Prime Minister in 1949. You know, I mean, after Churchill succeeded in Europe and with Britain, he lost, of course, the election to Attlee. You know, so there's no justice much in this world. But, you know, really, I mean, when you hear the libs these days talk about Ming, they ought to hang their heads in shame about him. You know, such a woeful coward he was, you know. So the thing is that John's book has all the clarity about Curtin. Here he is. He's an ordinary cove. He gets the job in 1935. He's got to deal with a split in the Labor Party. He gets the Lang Labor Party back together. In 1936, he talks about the risk to Australia, our unpreparedness in defence. He soldiers on against a weak government. Finally stays out, watches Menzies and Page, Menzies and Fadden collapse on the votes of the two independents, has the confidence of the two independents, becomes Prime Minister on the back of the two independents giving an undertaking to the Governor General, Gowrie, and on the back of that, without a national election, prosecutes a war, completely reversing the policy, making big decisions and making them quickly, bringing his party along with him, defiantly speaking about his obligations and trying to drag the country in behind him. And, of course, you know, I suppose it wasn't surprising that he and Churchill crossed each other's paths when Churchill wanted the Pacific War sort of decided in councils in London, where Australia wasn't always involved in these things. The big place where Curtin calls Churchill's bluff, of course, is our turning to the United States, turning away from Britain, which of course Churchill probably well and truly understood. This is where Curtin says, without any inhibitions, we're determined Australia shall not go free of any pangs of separation from Britain. We look to the United States for support. But notwithstanding his turn to the United States, we see him standing up to Roosevelt, and Roosevelt was pressuring him to bring the AIF back from the Middle East and to take them to Burma. He stood up Menzies, Page and Spender at the same time politically, domestically, as he stood up Churchill. So it's a big row, Roosevelt, Churchill, Menzies, Page and Spender. He insists on the AIF returning to Australia and not Burma. And, of course, in the subsequent development of the war, it would have been disastrous for our troops to have gone to Burma in these circumstances, and he brings them home. So he brings the troops back. He resists this. And, of course, he argues that the Pacific War Council should be run by the United States out of Washington, not out of London. And, of course, this was resisted by Churchill. Finally, it comes to pass. And then finally, of course, Roosevelt decides to take responsibility for the defence of Australia. John makes a lot of important points that are now forgotten. There was virtually no US Navy at this stage. The US battleships had all gone down in Pearl Harbor. Luckily, some of the aircraft carriers were at sea at the time. They had a very small army. There was no army really to defend Australia. And so now we assume there's a big American force there ready to come to our aid. Of course, there was no such American force. And so getting Roosevelt to accept responsibility from Australia, and this goes to a very important point. that Eisenhower had said from the outset that the natural base to resist the Japanese from was the fortress Australia, was the mainland of the island Australia. And over time, of course, the Americans came to the same conclusion that Eisenhower had come to, and that as a consequence, then, of course, with urging from Curtin, Roosevelt appoints MacArthur to run the Pacific War and instructs MacArthur to go from Corregidor down to Melbourne, which he does. And then, of course, Curtin is able to talk to the Americans directly through MacArthur rather than through the old imperial system in London to the Americans, where, of course, John records, where Page, as the High Commissioner, wouldn't even follow the instructions of his government in Australia, not showing cables to Churchill or the British government from Curtin. You know, this sort of behaviour, the willful behaviour of these people. He kept them on. He kept these appeasers on. But the thing, he went around them by, of course, once Churchill had made the commitment about Australia, and once the Pacific War was going to be fought from here, and once MacArthur came here, that happened. And this is a point I often make, and I know Bob Carr's made it a point. People talk about the United States and Australia now. I mean, what other part of the Pacific has a continent to itself? A similar political system, a democracy with jurisprudence. I mean, the Americans have been with us 100 years next year. I mean, General Monash commanded American troops in France 100 years ago next year. The idea that we've got to be sort of obsequious and fawning, lest some American official doesn't like what we say, lest we lose their support or their loyalty. You know, of course, you know, we are natural partners with the United States. It's just that in the intervening years, of course, we've seen the great state of China rising in the East, and therefore the political equilibrium has changed. So the great lessons, I think, Curtin, you know, we often speak that some people are critical of those of us, myself included, regarded as sort of radical nationalists. This is a point that fellow Curran often makes, radical nationalists. Well, let's say, thank God for one radical nationalist, John Curtin, you know, thank God for him, you know, against the odds, you know, to with his government of scum, as Menzies called them, you know, and there's Bob, you could see him dressed in the double-breasted suit, listening to Brudenell White tell him that basically, Prime Minister, you know, in the event the Japanese exercise sea control, of course, we could only fight against skirmishes. The whole idea of resisting an invasion, of marshalling the whole community, of the government being one in, all in, as Churchill said of Britain, was, of course, you know, an idea simply that Menzies wouldn't accept. And, of course, he collapses. Fadden gets the job, and then he collapses, and Curtin becomes Prime Minister. So John has brought these things out. I mean, the parallels between Churchill and Curtin are very profound, I think, you know. I mean, there's one great story I should tell you about Churchill. Of course, when the Tories had to give him the job, which they hated in Britain, they went through this sort of interview, if you like, the Tory elders, and they took him to some club, Churchill, and they're talking at that stage. Of course, Hitler's given the halt order to Rundstedt, and they've got the British Expeditionary Force holed up in Calais and Dunkirk. You know, the Dutch Queen has resigned, the Belgian King has abdicated but staying in Belgium. I mean, this is the situation. So they ask him about all these issues, and he gives them his answers, most of which, of course, they wouldn't have liked. And then they then retire to the smoking room later, and they said, "Now look, Winston, you know, we've been through the strategic matters, your general view about the war, but we'd just like to ask you a couple of questions about yourself." They said, "You know, Edward," that's Edward Fox, that was Lord Halifax. Edward, of course, he said, is an elder of the church. And we're just wondering about you. He said, "Look, let me come to the point." He said, you You inquire about my religious observance. You inquire whether I'm a pillar of the church. I am not, but I could be a flying buttress. I mean, that's the contempt, all that contemptuous bunch in. And, of course, there's that great story where he's sworn in at night by the king at 11 o'clock at night, and he drives across the Mall in the lone and darkness with all this terrible problems across the channel. And his driver says, "I'm sorry, Mr. Churchill, that you had to find a primacyship in these circumstances." He said, "Yeah, yes, George, but now I have the whole field of command at play." And this is the point. That's what Curtin had. He was given the job, unexpectedly given the job. He had the whole field of command, and there he is on one man, the core to strategic decisions, and in fact, as John points out, the whole shift in Australia's foreign policy attitude from that day onwards, from that period onwards, where no longer do we believe in Imperial Britain, looking for a strategic guarantor in Whitehall, where we were dragged to Asia by the Second World War, and Curtin, in a sense, by his management of the war effort, including his collaboration with the Americans, reshapes Australia and its attitude towards itself and the region from that period onwards. And this is a turn we made. Gough Whitlam, was just remarking earlier, Gough Whitlam makes the next big turn in the recognition of China in 1972. And of course, Australia as a nation has then been more, if you like, seen its future as tied up in Asia, particularly as the British joined the common market and left us then completely behind, and then finally left under the Five-Power Defence Agreement, all the arrangements around Singapore, Malaysia, in the 1960s, and from that moment on, we've sort of been an Asian, more or less an Asian power, a power within the Asian hemisphere. So John's written a mighty book. It's a beautiful read. It has a great narrative and storyline. It has these great revelations, like the Brunel White Murdoch conversation and his address to the Menzies cabinet. Instances of Curtin's personality and life, domestic life, the simplicity of his life, in a sense, the otherwise ordinariness of it all, and the fact, of course, that the job killed him doing it. That comes later, I assume, in Volume 2. So congratulations, John, on the book. On Penguin, the publisher, Ben's going to speak soon. I want to congratulate both John and Penguin, with much pleasure, launch the book.
Well, thank you, Paul. Paul has done John a favour by launching this book, but I think he's actually paid all of us. He's done all of us a favour by giving a substantial and entertaining speech on this history and the individuals and the moment and the weight of it. He hasn't left us in any doubt about what he thinks about some of the characters. Sometimes you go to book launches and you're not 100% sure whether the launcher has read the book, but we're in no doubt, Paul, that you've read every line, and your speech, to use your own language about John's book, your speech had its own drumbeat that I'm sure will be heard widely. So let me thank you for the conscientiousness with which you approached the task of launching John's book. You gave a couple of Churchill stories. I have to complete the trifecta. Your two stories are brilliant, but my favourite one is still the instance where after Pearl Harbor, in the very period that John's describing, Churchill went to Washington to confer with Roosevelt, stayed at the White House, stayed at the residence upstairs with Eleanor and various secretaries and so on. And at one point, Roosevelt wheeled himself into Churchill's room because Roosevelt had come up with the name for the alliance that was going to win the war. And the name, actually, interestingly, was the United Nations. Not many people know that before the United Nations described the international organization, it was the term that the Allies used for their alliance. And he wheeled himself into Churchill's room and was horrified to find Churchill in the bath because Churchill had set up a bathtub. And Roosevelt was all embarrassed and sort of Episcopalian about it and started to back out and said, "I'm sorry, Winston, I'll come back later." And Churchill stood up in his full majesty, naked, plump, pink and dripping, and said, "Franklin, come back. The Prime Minister of Great Britain has nothing to hide from the President of the United States." Of course, as Paul will tell us, alliances have become a bit less intimate since then. It's ironic, of course, that we're launching a book about Curtin and we're telling stories about Churchill. And this is perhaps one of the problems and one of the challenges that a biographer of John Curtin has, that he didn't have that outsized personality, didn't generate anecdotes perhaps in the way that that Winston Churchill did. But there's no doubt that Curtin was an enormously significant figure, and I know that John's book will go a long way towards righting that imbalance. Let me now call upon John Edwards to make a few remarks. John is one of our leading economists and public intellectuals. He's a good friend of the Institute. He's had a fascinating career working as a journalist for the Financial Review, the Australian and the Herald, before becoming economics advisor to Mr. Keating. He later became a chief economist for HSBC in Australia and New Zealand. He served as an economic advisor to Bahrain. He served as a member of the board of the Reserve Bank. He's now an adjunct professor with the Curtin Institute in WA. And of course, he's a long-term non-resident fellow here at the Institute. John Curtin, as Paul said, has been a constant theme in many ways of the last couple of decades of John's life. As Paul mentioned, John gave a very interesting lecture on John Curtin at Curtin University, I think it was in 2001 or thereabouts. In 2005, he published his important book, Curtin's Gift, and now we have the first volume of this major two-volume biography on John Curtin's life. I think he is increasingly making a case for himself as the leading authority on John Curtin. So let me welcome John Edwards to the lectern.
Thanks indeed, Michael. I just want to say a few thank yous. The first, of course, to Paul for evocation. Just the most thrilling evocation. It's curious when you write a book of this length, and of course, as Paul said, it's only the first volume. You, after all, your memory of what's actually in it fades. And Paul's brought it all back to me, you know, and I thought, how exciting, you know, what a good idea to write a book about this character. So winningly spoken, Paul. Thank you so much. And so true, and so passionate. Well, let me just a few thanks. Of course, thanks to everybody, friends, family, those interested in Curtin, those wanting to hear Paul who came along today. Thanks very much indeed. I haven't met Toby and Michael Davidson. I'm looking forward to doing so. The great grandsons of John Curtin, who was my John Curtin's son. So they're most welcome here. Toby gave a really good talk a few years ago about poetry and Curtin. A very, very good talk. I had planned to knock it off in my book, but I just ran out of space. But anyway, I urge you, if you're interested in Curtin and poetry, look it up. To Ben Ball of Penguin, I mean, what a, you know, splendid production. And, I mean, it just looks authoritative. And and particularly the cover, completely uncluttered. But the fact that my name is not on the front is not, you know. You could go to the back, oh, Julia Gillard, but no, can't be by Julia Gillard. She wouldn't have had time to. But then it's on the back. It's on the back. You can find it there if you look for it. So, Ben, that was fantastic. Beautifully, beautifully done book by Louisa Maggio, your designer. I thank the editors at Penguin, Hilary Reynolds, Mark Evans, proofread the book, and Faye Heffenbaum put it all together. My friend Barry Howarth did the index for this book, as he's done the indexes for books I've done in the past, and superbly well. The book's been so long in gestation that I should also mention that Ben's predecessor, Bob Sessions, was actually the one who commissioned this book so long ago, I'm embarrassed to say. And Mary Canane was the agent for it at the time, and she's since left the business. Now, I'm not sure whether John Nethercott is here tonight. Whether he's... Oh, was he? Patty, thank you. Thank you. I had thought John was the British, you know, collapse, the English collapse on the, what was it, day four. I thought that was going to let him. He called me last night and said he thought he'd be able to get away today, but it must have been more prolonged. John. John is was also the editor of this book. A friend of mine, great editor. We have an unusual kind of relationship. His heroes are Menzies and John Howard. We both love music, so that's. And he's a critic, a fanatic, which is, you know, as I say, is why he's not here tonight. Let me give you an instance of John's extraordinary attention to detail, from which this book benefited. To detail and to correct procedure, we were having lunch recently and we'd ordered sparkling water as a drink. It wasn't the only drink we ordered, but we did order sparkling water, and the waiter produced it with a wonderful flourish and poured it into a glass in front of him. And John said, no, please, I would prefer a champagne flute. Now, this just, I just would not have the front to say that sort of thing. I just thought, how magnificent that he could insist upon a champagne flute for sparkling water. But that's the sort of person he is. He has a very artisanal approach to editing. He's not really strong on computers, that sort of thing. And so you send him a digital file and he'll print it off and then he'll do everything on the paper, send it back to you, which is marvellous. But for me, it was a kind of an education. You'd be sitting there putting John's things into comma, 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 comma. He's very strong on commas. Parliament sometimes has uppercase, sometimes lowercase. Cabinet sometimes uppercase. You know, it's all fine distinctions in John's mind. But for me, just a wonderful improvement, I think, in my understanding of the English language. So thanks very much indeed to John for that. Here at Lowy, I particularly want to thank Andrea Pollard and Jennifer Reinhardt, who organised, put a huge amount of work into organising this evening's event. And of course, Michael. I'm very proud. Michael's a great host tonight, as ever. I'm very proud indeed to be associated with Lowy. It's been a very fruitful for me relationship. Michael, of course, as Paul said, Michael, of course, is an eminent scholar of World War II, with his book on Roosevelt and Harry Hopkins and the US alliance with the UK and the Soviet Union. So Michael and I have much to discuss. The politics of World War II, Japan, China, the decay of the international liberal order. Much to talk about. So far, we've mainly talked about house prices, but this is Sydney. Well, they're my main thanks, Paul. I should thank my family for being so understanding, for Deborah for being so understanding of this very long and not for other people always pleasurable experience. To thank Paul for such a magnificent, kind, generous speech. Thank you, Paul. Thank you.
Thanks very much, John. Thank you for what you said about me. You were on the board of the Reserve Bank for 5 years, so if I can't ask you about house prices, who can I ask about? I was remiss in not welcoming Deborah, so Deborah, welcome and congratulations to you. I know what a huge thing these books are for partners and family members, so congratulations. John, let me say I'm glad the launch served the purpose of reminding the author of what was in his book, so I'm glad we've ticked that box. Ladies and gentlemen, finally, let me call on Ben Ball of Penguin Random House, who's not only John's publisher, but my publisher, and indeed the Lowy Institute's publisher. We collaborate a couple of times a year. We think we're the first think tank in the world to have our leading publications not sort of distributed from the lobby, but indeed published by the best trade publisher in the country and distributed and sold in newsagents and bookstores around the country. It's been a really wonderful collaboration over a number of years. I should say that the next Lowy Institute paper will be launched next May by our deputy director, Anthony Bubalo, on the title Remaking the Middle East, because we only go for big issues at the Lowy Institute. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Ben Ball.
Thank you, Michael. It's one of our great pleasures as a publishing house to have this wonderful relationship with the Lowy Institute. It raises the tone of our company by several notches, and I get to come here every so often. So it's win-win as far as I'm concerned. As John said, Michael's always a wonderful host, so I'd like to thank the Lowys for hosting us this evening and all of you for coming. I'd like to thank Mr. Keating for a truly wonderful and fully engaged speech. Michael pointed out earlier on that you do go to some launches where sometimes one suspects that the book has not entirely been read or digested, but I think it does great honour to an author and very incidentally to a publisher to have somebody read and consider a work in such depth, so thank you very much. My main thanks go to John, though, for writing this book. It is true that my predecessor signed the contract some possibly 10 years ago. John's had a lot on his plate. So after that 10 years, as it now is the custom, an electronic file came into the email. And it did. I greeted it with great delight, actually, because I knew the author, obviously, and the premise of the book, and I was very much looking forward to reading it. It did take me some time to read. John was very kind not to mention that, because it's of an unfashionable length in publishing. But it didn't take very long to know that, and I hope some of you will have this experience, to know that we're in the hands of a master biographer. I think this is a truly landmark work of writing. I'm not in a position to comment like some other people have commented on the, I'm no historian, but I read a lot of books, and this is a truly great one. We did end up dividing it into two volumes. I think that's the right thing to do, partly because for health and safety reasons, but and we get to charge you twice for it, but mainly because it seems very fitting for the work itself. I'm very proud to be involved in a publication of this quality that takes as seriously as this book takes an Australian leader. One sees this sort of publishing in the US and the UK from time to time, but it's too uncommon here. John, of course, considers it an individual and his times in great, evocative and enormously pleasurable depth. So, John, thank you very much for the book. Congratulations. The AFR is already clamoring for volume two, so that's great news. And thank you all for coming. Good evening.
Thank you, Ben. Look, that wraps up proceedings. Let me say a couple of things. I know everybody is going to buy a copy of this book, which is on sale here to my right. There's no excuse for attending a book launch and not buying a book. I say that as an author. Let me give you a short ad before you go, seeing as we have such a distinguished audience here. The Institute is not often doing book launches, but we're always discussing the kinds of issues that Mr. Keating drew out in his remarks. On the 7th of December, some of you will be interested that Lowy Institute scholars will lead a discussion here on what Xi Jinping's new era means for China and the world. And a week later, on the 14th of December, we'll be hosting Australia's ambassador to the United States, Joe Hockey, for an update from Washington. So the discussions go on. Thank you all again for attending. I want to thank in particular Ben Ball. I'd like to thank Paul Keating for his very memorable remarks. And most importantly, I want to congratulate John Edwards on the launch of John Curtin's War. There is some champagne somewhere, so you don't even have to have sparkling water in your champagne flute tonight, John. Thank you.